Welcome to Observations, wherever you may be. We're here with Scott and Kirk, and we're going to pick up where we were a week ago with the transition from the pharaohs of Egypt, who were Egyptian. Mitzrayim is the was the name of the country from Yahweh's perspective. It's still Mitzra today, and if you were to ask an Egyptian what they are, they're Mitzra. Mitzrayim is just the plural of it. Means crucibles in Hebrew. And once Pharaoh and his army were swallowed up in the Red Sea following their last-minute chase of the slaves out of their country, the Hebrew slaves, there was a power vacuum there. And plus they were also trying to deal with the terrible plagues that had befallen the country, and so there was a shortage of food. There was buildings were destroyed, and the leadership was gone. Plus, the priesthood, which was had worked in harmony with the political rulership of Egypt, they had lost all their credibility.
That's right.
So the purpose of the plagues, each one of them, was to destroy the credibility of the religious leaders of Egypt, and the religion and the political leadership were one and the same, and us political leadership and military leadership were one and the same as well. And so all three, whether they drowned in the Gulf of Aqaba, of part of the Red Sea, or were discredited during the plagues, Egypt was had a vacuum of power.
I ain't kidding. Well, think about it. When you lose food, clothing, shelter, and security, and the gods you were supposed to be, were supposed to save you, and they don't, then you are in a heck of a mess. So
from a present day point of view, if the American military were to go away, if the American government were to go away, I would be in a preferable place than we are right now. So, but in this place, they did not have they did not know the Creator God of the universe. They did not know His testimony. They were not in a position to turn to Him because they had rejected Him.
Well, speaking of that point, just real quickly, this is an armed populace, so the chance of being invaded or somebody wanting to take over the country would be very, 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 very difficult. I mean, outside of nuclear, nuclear solves nothing but kills everybody. So
it's impossible. America cannot be occupied. That's the whole reason why the military wasn't necessary. It's why the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution exists. Is if the population is armed, then it becomes impossible for any nation to invade and occupy the country. We do not need the U.S. military to protect American freedom and to keep America safe from invasion. The Second Amendment, with people having guns, does that. And so you have to question, so what is the purpose of the U.S. military? Because it sure as heck isn't for American liberty.
No, Hirohito, I think, asked his generals, he said, why don't we just invade them? He says, they're all armed, we can't.
Yeah, that's right. You can't. It's impossible. It's absolutely impossible for anyone to invade and occupy America. You can destroy aspects of it, but pretty soon you won't even have to do that because we as Americans have done too good a job of destroying ourselves. Yeah. It's kind of like the Vandals and the Visigoths and the like when they rolled into to Rome, and the late 3rd and 4th centuries and early 5th century, it wasn't that they had any great military prowess. It's just that Rome had destroyed itself morally, economically, in every possible way long before they fell. They didn't die from foreign invader. They died from within.
Yeah.
And that's the same story as the United States.
Well, the parallels are of any civilization going to pot. This is as good as any if you want a picture of what's coming for.
Yeah, what's interesting too, and I've never thought about this before, but there are 10 plagues that Yahweh unleashed on Yisrael, on Egypt on behalf of Yisrael, of his children. The world is 10 years from entering a 7-year tribulation.
Yes.
during the second half of that tribulation, there will be a series of plagues. And, you know, it's almost a flashback.
Right.
That just as Egypt was plagued, the world's going to be plagued.
Yeah, I saw that going through this material. I said, boy, this is really close to home.
Yes. And there really isn't a lot of difference between the integration of religion, which is now socialist secular humanism in America, the political aspect of government and the military aspect. They're all intertwined along with the economic issues. And by keeping so many people as dependents and by taxing people in so many different ways, you really do have a master-slave culture here that mirrors much of what existed in Egypt.
Yeah.
All those years ago. So it should be no wonder that our dollar has the eye of Osiris and the pyramid symbol on it. Yeah, really shouldn't be a surprise.
And we hate Israel too. So how about that?
Yes, yeah. That's right. That's the nation claims to be the great friend of Israel, and yet there's no nation that has done Israel more harm. The United States sells 25 times more sophisticated weaponry to Israel's foes than it does to Israel, and the United States has been arming and funding Israel's foes for many, many decades now, and it is the principal power behind the forfeiture of Gaza, which turned out to be devastating for Israel. It's the primary impetus trying to force Israel to give up Judea and Samaria, which has been falsely called the West Bank. And Trump came in and said, "Oh, yeah, I'm going to move the embassy to Jerusalem, and we're not going to encourage the Israelis to stop building settlements, and we're not going to even seek a Palestinian state." And the moment he got into power, he reneged on all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, the meeting between Netanyahu and Trump that took place, what, about 2 months ago? Just shy of 2 months ago?
Thanks.
You know, there's been absolutely no press as to what was said. The only way that Bibi Netanyahu doesn't disclose what was said in that meeting is because what was said in that meeting is that Trump reneged on everything that he'd promised.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. He's really a phony.
Oh, he is a phony. I view him as an extraordinarily dangerous man.
Yeah.
And I think that the next 4 years in America are going to be frightening.
Yeah, I don't hear anything. I don't keep up with news too much unless it pertains to what we discuss and
yes, prophecy.
Israel or something very personal
mm-hmm.
nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never seen so many people so frightened. We talked about this before. I know during, obviously, if you were in the war zone or something, one of the previous wars, World War II, and you got bombed, you'd be quite nervous. But there's kind of a universal fear that, because this is a nuclear age, we know they have nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
People have.
Oh, worldwide. Worldwide.
Worldwide. Yeah. People are scared to death.
Yes, and for good reason. And for good reason, they ought to be.
They should be.
They ought to be. Yeah, the people who have access to those weapons cannot be trusted.
That's right. Well, where we left.
Why don't we pick
left?
Back up? We were at Exodus 14 at the end of the last program, where you were talking about what was considered to be the 11th plague.
Well, what we found out is obviously that in Exodus 14, Yahweh talked about how the Egyptians were destroyed. So then you have the vacuum that we were just discussing. So, but the beauty of that was we had so many parallels to it from antiquities, from written by Griffin, and we had Josephus, who wrote Manetho's. What fragments he had left of his. He had quite a lot that was copied down by Josephus, so we have a pretty good idea of what he wrote.
And Manetho is the person that they that he was quoting. So yeah, he was and he wrote
Eupiger
in the
did too, and so did Africanus. So I mean, there's quite a few sources there. But you know, Manetho, I don't know whether I ever mentioned that in here, but Manetho was hired by Ptolemy the First to write the histories of Egypt, and it's important to know because he had access to everything. Temples and the libraries that he wanted to write this history for them.
Right. Before the Muslims and Christians destroyed the libraries.
Yeah, that's the general, one of the four generals of Alexander that took over the south.
Right.
Later led to the family of Cleopatra and so forth and so on. But what he had was access to a lot of things, but there's a negative side to Manetho, if you study a little bit on him, in that he decided to write down from those records a chronology. And that chronology was also copied by Josephus or certain people, and historians have always used that. The trouble with that, as we'll find out a little bit later, is that he was incorrect. He has whole areas, whole swaths of things, especially the whole Dark Ages of the Amalekites that are not recorded.
Yeah. So, and there's a lot of that in both the Greek and Roman histories. If you ever wanted to study a group of people that can't be trusted, read the Greek and Roman historians. They were all propagandists, and they were very much like Homer. You know, Homer told a history of Troy through the Iliad and the Odyssey. But the history that he told of Troy was designed to convey a military and religious mythos about the Greeks. And so it was, 5% true and 95% false.
Good story.
Yeah. And that's when you read the propagandists that were writing histories, both, and Josephus would fall right into this, for both Greece and Rome.
Right.
They were all storytellers that existed at the behest of the religious and political establishment, which was also the military establishment, to create an aura of patriotism and of militarism and of political pride in the country. So it isn't surprising that you have a Greek historian weaving an element of truth into a really good story.
Well, it also points out that another reason not to trust the academia of the world, it's never been true. I mean, most of the stuff in here that we've been talking about, I had read very early, and when I got to college, I would argue with people. Now, I wanted to make straight A's so I could go faster and take more overloads. So I always gave them back what they wanted on the test.
Right.
But I was a bit of a pain to some of my professors because they would imply that, well, everyone knows it's such and such and such and such. I said, no,
we don't.
But a lot of these guys, I was very fortunate that I got to illustrate their articles in different magazines.
Yeah, it's I don't know why it reminded me of this, but, you know, the age of the Earth now, because of the Wilkinson probe and the cosmic radiation background from the Big Bang that has been measured, and we say that the universe now is 13.7 billion years old. Well, that age is based entirely on the temperature of quark confinement. And there are there's a range of options. And the number that is picked is not actually the most likely of the numbers, but because it has been accepted, it was the first accepted early on, no one wants to change. Yeah, no one wants to change it because then that would make these claims look foolish. The same thing is true with Egyptology. The professors and the textbooks and all of this have been written on the timeline that was originally articulated as Manetho began his study. Yeah, and they haven't shown a willingness to correct it. And
well, you can't let facts get in the way of a good story.
No, it's. And you don't want to discredit those who came before, because then you'll be discredited.
Don't want to allow the Torah to be true.
Well, there's a lot of that, too.
The ramifications of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a real attempt to negate anything that that affirms the Torah in academia.
Well, where I moved from that destruction of the pharaohs and the whirl and the water,
mm-hmm.
whirlpools rather, I moved to that, and then I had a little bit of an aside. What I did next was a little bit early, but I'm trying to the heart of what I was trying to do in the first few things was to establish that these things correspond, that there's so much evidence that corresponds to the notion that the Amalekites not only invaded Egypt, they also ruled for years and years and years and years. I would suggest to you it's over 400 and a half years, 440 years probably. Would be mm-hmm. a pretty good number I would pick. And so I injected on the thing a quote here that will come into play a little bit later, which is the important inscription of a queen. I call her a queen because she was a female pharaoh. Her name mm-hmm. was Hatshepsut, mm-hmm. which is hard to say, but we'll call her Susu.
Okay.
Here's what she said. She said, the abode of the mistress of Keys was fallen in ruin. She's talking about a temple and the temples of her time. And the earth has swallowed up her beautiful sanctuaries, and the children played over her temple. And I cleared it, and I built it anew. I restored that which was in ruins, and I completed that which was left unfinished. For there had been Amu, which is the Egyptian name for Amalekites, in the midst of the delta, and in Haver. Haver is another name for for avarice or El-Arish.
Mm-hmm.
And the foreign hordes of their number had destroyed the ancient works, and they had reigned ignorant of the god Ra. And that came from William Flinders Petrie, who in his History of Egypt, he translated these inscriptions, and I have nothing to date that would suggest that he was wrong about that. Now, the reason that's important is because it does describe that this place was left wasted.
Correct.
The problem you have when you just see this and put it into context is that we have on the Manetho timeline, we mm-hmm. have Hatshepsut mm-hmm. in way earlier when we find out later that she's actually a contemporary of Solomon. Now, mm-hmm. I'll prove it to you later, but in any case, it describes, now, if I'm correct, if the Torah is correct and she's the one that met with Solomon, then what you have here is a description of a wasted land, because if she was a queen earlier, she mm-hmm. could have repaired it earlier, but the safe of the correct. Land was wasted.
Correct.
So it just builds on itself. Hatshepsut is, Manetho also wrote in his History of the in Greek. His volumes, by the way, are not extant. We've talked about that. However,
by the way, just a couple of other thoughts here. Avarice okay. happens to be in the Goshen area as well, so yep. we're talking about the same area. The other thought I want to raise is that it did affirm that the Amalekites, were mm-hmm. Were the problem, and so that's another affirmation. And the third is that this was a showdown between Yahweh and Ra.
Yeah.
And Ra lost.
Ra lost. Big time.
Yes, and that's what she's affirming. Mm-hmm. They had resigned, ignorant of the god Ra. Ra lost.
Mm-hmm. And avarice comes into play big time again, because we find out that was quite a fortress for the Amu. And we'll find out that it wasn't destroyed until we get to the time of Solomon. I mean,
okay.
sorry, to the time of Shaul, King
okay.
Saul.
Okay.
So I'm going to read a little bit about Manetho, what he wrote, also that about these people. And he said that the race bore a genetic name, and he called them Hyksos, or Hyksos, which is Greek for king shepherds. For the Hyk is a sacred language, and a sacred language denotes king, and the Sos in the common dialect means shepherd. And the okay. combined words form Hyksos. It also means, according to Josephus, he also included that it meant rulers from foreign countries. So we're not talking about an Egyptian heritage of pharaohs here as well.
Right.
And there's a little more mention in the Torah about the events in Egypt post-Exodus. But Apura completes the records where he says, it tells of invaders, that vexed and tormented the land of Egypt, the tenth plague was not the last, yet after another one was to follow. And the cruel conqueror invaded the once mighty realm, now overthrown and prostrate. He subjected it without meeting resistance. And and that's also included in the section on, bear with me.
Yeah, by the way, you're talking about shepherds, where yes. they were kings. The Egyptians were not shepherds. In fact, the surrounding nations, which had been rivals, were not shepherds. And there's no indication that that any of the powers, whether it be Assyria or Babylon, they were not shepherds.
No.
So so if you're looking for, well, who were the shepherds? The shepherds were in northern and in far western Arabia.
Yeah, and they were always called king shepherds. Everywhere the Amu were, right. they called them king shepherds. And that bothered me because sometimes you'll hear, you know, David being a shepherd king.
Right.
And so I'll finish the quote just a second.
Okay.
And so I was looking at that, and I looked up the goyim approach to what a king is and what a shepherd is. And, of course, a king being the first word, because it's always written that way, king shepherd, and we think of Dode being a shepherd king.
Right, a shepherd who became a king, right.
So I looked up the king, and, you know, and to them it's just a sovereign ruler. To the ordinary person, it's a sovereign ruler, a leader, a ruler of a kingdom. Mm-hmm. The shepherd's the one who tend the sheep. I mean, you don't get much deeper than that. Right. However, when they talk about Dode, he's a shepherd king. So I looked up the Hebrew for shepherd, and the word that emphasizes as Ra'ah or Ra'i or Roy, depending on your pronunciation, mine's usually poor, but it is one who watches, Shamar, one who watches over his sheep, feeder of the flock, and friend.
Mm-hmm.
The Ra'ain Yod, shepherd, mm-hmm. who watches over his flock, who directs, instructs, guides his flock, and protects his flock.
Yeah.
Now, that's a whole different connotation.
That's why Yosha told Shimon Kefesh, a shepherd, my flock, and told him it over and over and over again, and why several times Dode is specifically asked to shepherd the flock, and there's one time he says, you know, he wasn't a very good shepherd on that issue.
No.
So shepherding, Yahweh likes to refer to his people as his sheep.
Yeah.
And that's why Yahweh's the first letter in Almighty God and the first letter in Father, Ab, is the ram's head.
Yeah.
You know, so Yahweh views us as sheep, but he views himself as part of us. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The power of the house, the head of the house, the leader of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look at Melech, the king, you have a leader. The oldest things I can find there from the roots is a leader who walks among his people and one who consults and is a counselor. And I thought that interesting. Now, there's only one shepherd king. There are lots of king shepherds.
Right.
There's only one shepherd.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, Dode.
Yeah.
David.
Yeah, Dode.
Yes.
So we were reading, let's see, the...
So what's interesting there is you have an independent corroboration that the shepherd peoples had come into to Egypt without any resistance because, the entire infrastructure of Egypt was destroyed at the during and post Exodus.
Mm-hmm. And so they came in without any resistance. Obviously, that's should be clear because the army was gone and so forth, plus they were destroyed. Mm-hmm. And these people they're talking about, he said they desecrated his sacred places, and he raped his surviving women, enslaved and decimated the population. He utterly destroyed the temples as if any remained erect. He robbed the sepulchres of the dead.
God, that sounds like the Islamic State today, doesn't it?
who might be?
Well, that sounds like the first Muslims in the under Muhammad and then the first 100 years after Muhammad's death.
Uh-huh.
That depiction is Islam today. Yeah. I mean that is Islam.
Yes, sir.
So it's the precursor of Islam.
Yeah.
I guess it makes sense then that the first 70 surahs of the Quran were based on Arabian pagan mythology. And the pagan culture of Arabia is, in fact, the Amalekite culture.
And well, how can you draw any other conclusion?
Well, it's
they destroy everything. They build nothing. They destroy. I mean, they built a fort. They ruled. And they only build things in order to keep control. But they don't build anything worthwhile. There's no culture. There's no great. See, if they had written everything down.
Right.
It's been like a normal culture.
It was like the Arabia, there was no written language.
Right.
Written Arabic doesn't it didn't even exist until in Syria, Hebrew, the Hebrew alphabet was used to convey vocal Arabic sounds. And so it's exactly the same thing. You know, Muslims don't build anything. Mm-hmm. And they are vicious, they're rapists. They are mass murderers, and they destroy the all of the cultural buildings of whatever land they conquer. And their idea of conquer is to bludgeon and then to rob and rape.
Well, the end of his speech here about Poro says he and they mutilated the victims who remained alive.
Oh, which is what Muhammad did.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the first raid of Muhammad Badr, he mutilated the victims. In fact, even shows him at Khaybar, which preceded that or which followed that, mutilating people.
Yeah.
So no, it's like this is Islam.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the Amalekites came from Arabia, according to Pura. And the Israelites left Egypt towards Asia, and of course mm-hmm. they met. And the first encounter was with Amalek came this way. Before they, Israel, reached Mount Sinai, Horeb, they met the hordes of Amalek at Meribah, or the foot of Horeb, where the people thirsted for water in the bed of the stony valley, came Amalek.
Yeah, isn't that funny that it'd be at Horeb? Mm-hmm. First of all, you know, Moshe left Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
He ran into King Shepherds.
Right.
And the place that he was himself shepherding sheep was Horeb. Mount Horeb. And Mount Horeb is in Western Arabia.
Yes.
Mount Horeb is just Arab. As you go across the Gulf of Aqaba, crossing from Nuweiba Beach, which is the only place where you could gather a lot of people, and it's the only place there's a land bridge where if the waters were parted, people could still walk across the Gulf of Aqaba, part of the Red Sea, leads directly to Horeb. You can see pictures of Horeb today. The top of the mountain is charred black. You can even see the place where the water gushed out of the rock. You can see the altar that the children of Israel made to the golden calf, which was the sacred bull worship that was so popular in Egypt. And so that's where they met. That happens to be Arabia.
Yeah. That's almost due east, isn't it? Or is it a little bit south?
Well, if you go across the land bridge of the Gulf of Aqaba from Nuweiba Beach directly across, that's where Horeb is. It's within a half a day's walk of the eastern bank of the Gulf of Aqaba, directly across from Nuweiba Beach. The Nuweiba Beach is easy to find. It's the only large beach on the Gulf of Aqaba.
Yeah.
It's on the western shore, and Horeb's on the just inland from the eastern shore.
Yeah. Well, when they meet there, and the Israelites meet in Rephidim, they meet the Amalekites, this causes a series of events, and we'll turn to Exodus 17:18. Mm-hmm. Moshe and Aaron and Hur, I'm just talking now, went up to the top of the hill. Mm-hmm. Joshua fought the Amalek, and at some point the Amalek were winning the battle. But as we go to Exodus 17:13-16, Joshua discomforted Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And Yahweh said to Moshe, write this for a memorial in a book, for I will utterly put out of remembrance of the Amalekite, or the Amalek, from under heaven. And Moshe built an altar and called the name of it Yahweh Nisi. For he said, behold, Yahweh has sworn that he, Yahweh, will have war with Amalekite or Amalek from generation to generation. And of course,
yeah, by the way, from generation to generation means that for a long time they're going to continue to exist, and then finally, when there are no more generations, I'm going to destroy all recollection of them. And so they continued through Islam.
Well, that was, you know, what I did. I don't know whether you got the thing Terry sent you this morning that I did, but I went back to those things and translated them as best as I could on Exodus 17:14, and where Yahweh said to Moshe that, if you'll give me a few more minutes.
Yeah, actually, I did. I received it while I was doing a radio show with, yeah. I did Dr. Bill's radio show.
Radio show, by the way.
Yeah, I did Dr. Bill's radio show today. We got along on most things except his conspiratorial theories on destructions of a couple of buildings. But other than that, it was an opportunity to talk about the things of Yahweh and the things that Yahweh despises. Go ahead.
You know, it was a good show. Good show. In 17:14, he says, Moshe, write this down. He told Yahweh, tells Moshe, write this down in the book and as a memorial, and recite it as to Yosha, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. And when I read something like that,
but Kirk, it's, it then it says from generation to generation.
Well, it does later, and then it
yeah, very that Yahweh clear. Will have war with Amalek from generation to generation.
Yeah.
So, this is not a conflict. It only appears so it only appears so out of context, and when you don't think in Hebrew.
Yeah,
in Hebrew, all Yahweh
said. Yeah, I resolved it myself, but I thought it's interesting. If you anyone who's making a casual read of this and wondering what happened, because then the historians don't tell you about Amalek very much.
Right.
One more event, and then you go, well, he must have quieted him. I mean, he must have done exactly what he said, but he can't do it there because there's generation after generation after generation.
Go give you an example. Yahweh tells Moshe to write it in a book.
Right.
So he's writing it down in the Torah that Yahweh is going to blot out the memory of the of these people from heaven. And that Yahweh is, and he's also in the book, that Yahweh is going to fight them from generation to generation. Mm-hmm. So he couldn't have been saying, I'm going to obliterate all memory of them at that moment. And to demonstrate that, I want you to have you memorialize the memory of
them. Right,
of them. So what he's saying is that they, they would come out and represent Islam later. I'm going to have to fight them from generation to generation. But when we transition into the millennial celebration of the Shabbat, I will have wiped out Islam, and I will have I'm going to wipe out all memory of these warlike, politicized, militant, religious peoples and institutions.
Well, what it allowed me to do, it piqued my curiosity enough to go through it a little bit deeper and just try to figure out, he's talking from when to when, and obviously it's end-time prophecy as well.
Yeah. Well, David would have to fight them, and then we're dealing with them again in end-times prophecy. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. That they are, in essence, the basis of the Magog War.
Right. And it's very clear. So I wasn't convinced that it went that far, but it just says that right there. That's the beauty of where I get to be now than where I used to be.
Yeah.
That working with y'all and listening to y'all and knowing how to translate enough that I can know when I'm being conned, or at least know when this is okay. Well, wait a minute. That has to agree. And then by the time you do it, you go, "Oh, well, he said exactly what he meant."
Yeah, exactly. The there's a lot of things you have to keep in mind when rendering a Hebrew passage from Yahweh. Mm-hmm. One of them is that in Hebrew, the verbs are infinite in time. So to constrain them in time and to apply this to say, "I'm going to wipe out all memory of them at that moment." Mm-hmm. Would be incorrect. He's going to wipe out all memory in conjunction with the spiritual realm. The spiritual realm really doesn't come to be until the end of the millennial Shabbat. That's what he's talking about there. And he's saying specifically that he's going to war with them from generation to generation. That means, and Dor is generation. It means through throughout time.
Mm-hmm.
You have to think in Hebrew.
But I get that when you get into it, and then you go, oh, okay, well, it has to be duh.
Right, right. And also, in these stories, while these stories are historically accurate, mm-hmm. Yahweh is not telling you the story for you to have an appreciation of history.
No.
He's telling you the story so that you understand what he is attempting to do, what he despises, what he's going to fight, and what he appreciates. And almost all of the characters, like the entirety of, you mentioned, King Saul, mm-hmm. Shaul. King Shaul is not told for the purpose of King Shaul.
No.
He's told for the purpose of the apostle, wannabe apostle, Shaul, known to Christians as Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And so Egypt in our world is the United States.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah. And the Amalekic is Islam.
Yes.
So he's telling you this story so that you might have an appreciation for what the negative influences are in over humanity. And there was a period of time where all these negative characteristics of Egypt were manifest in Rome.
Yes. Whoever seems to be the empire at the time, and I dare say the English Empire was, you know, they were merciless.
Yes, they were.
And they took their religion
Right. Everywhere
they went, and
right.
There's no mm-hmm. peoples on earth where they conquered where they treated them well.
Correct.
So,
all
we are is an extension right. from England. They grew up and to be bigger than them, so
yeah,
we took
correct.
Over from where they left off. So, after
correct.
They bankrupted themselves. So.
Correct.
Yeah. So, I gave a little background history next on mm-hmm. because Amalekites divided into two parts, and one went up to Canaan. It seems to be pretty evident there from different historical sources that they split in two on the way up, and the ones that went down to Egypt were probably a secondary unit because they had heard all the rumors about it and figured out, let's go down and see if that's really true, and then they conquered both. Then they just took over. The second encounter, though, with the Amalekites, as far as the Israelites were concerned, was in Numbers 13:29, and because the Amu migrated to Syria as well as Egypt, and they were shut off, they shut off everything except the south of Cana. And Numbers 13:29, the Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, so we have a correlation there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Israelites had been hounded by the merciless pirates, in my words, across the desert, almost defeated the Rephidim, and now discovered that they were beat to the promised land and would have to mm-hmm. fight them again to enter. And if you remember the story with the 12 men, the spies, was it 12 or 10? My mind may be going up, but there was her and Joshua, I know, said we can take them, and the rest of them said mm-hmm. no.
Yes.
But when they brought that message back, they wept that night because mm-hmm. Numbers 14:1, and they claimed, you know, would God that would it was better that they had died in the land of Egypt, or would God have let them die? Then God let them die in the wilderness. So they obviously were terribly, terribly afraid. They didn't trust him. 14:2, just to get a clear picture. They became afraid they would not enter and even threatened to kill Moshe.
Right.
And they all said, surely you shall not see the land which I swore to your fathers.
Right. And there's a reason for that. Yahweh is not tolerant. He's not accepting.
No.
He hates what should be hated. It's one of the greatest problems we have today is not understanding that you cannot be a loving father. You cannot be someone who cares for his or her family if you don't hate that which is vicious, that which is misleading, that which is counterproductive. And so Yahweh hated them. They were in the land, and until the Israelites were willing to confront them and rid their presence of this, just like until we recognize that we can't cohabitate with Islam, we must completely separate ourselves from Islam. Mm-hmm. We can't do business with them. We shouldn't be accepting or tolerant. If you don't learn that lesson, then you can't live in peace.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be plagued.
Yeah.
So that's why God says you're not moving. You're not moving into the home because you didn't learn this lesson. It's like buying a home that is flea infested, that is that termites are holding hands to keep the building up, and it's got rats in it with plague, and it's filled with venomous snakes. And said, "Yeah, let's everybody kind of get along, and it's just part of nature, and we'll just all move into this. So we'll move our family and our children into this house." No, what you're doing is stupid. God's saying, if you're not willing to deal with these venomous creatures, then no, you're not moving into my house.
Well, they got nervous then, and they said to Yahweh, they said, okay, we'll go up now. They're a little late now, because in Numbers 14:42-45, Moshe says, go not up. Yah's not among you. The Amalekites and the Canaanites are before you, and you will fall by the sword. And they did anyway, and bunches of them got killed. There is a cutoff point. There's a time when, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be with you. If you ain't going with me, I ain't going with you.
Right, right.
So,
yeah, I'm smarter than you are. I'm going to tell you what I want and why I want it. And if you're not willing to listen to me and act upon what I am saying, then you're not coming into my home.
Yeah. So that prompted a question that if they had followed Yahweh's advice and had prevailed the first time instead of the whole generation, then the whole generation, they lost the whole generation. They lost everybody from age 25
right.
on up.
Right, yeah.
And just because they...
And they had to wander around in the wilderness for an entire generation because they did not listen to and act upon. You know, it's like, what would have happened if Noah didn't listen to Yahweh's advice on building the ark? Yeah.
That would have been even more tragic. That would have wiped out everybody. That's the last remnant.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, what would have happened? If they had listened to him, what would have happened?
Yeah.
No, they'd have moved into the promised land.
They would have saved everybody.
Absolutely. Right.
Yeah. Yahweh's not incapable of saving more people. He's incapable of saving people who don't want to listen to him.
Correct. He is incapable of saving people who don't want to listen to him, which would be every religious person on the planet.
Exactly. What I was going to say, instead of the other side of that coin for them not going in, and then him wandering, having them wander around till he kills off that generation in the wilderness for 40 years. The Amalekites, by every account, were the most vicious of all the tribes. When they take over the promised land, they infested. Now, I'm not saying that the Philistines or the Philistines were decent human beings to begin with, or the Ebionites or any of these other people were. But by the time they are taken over by this powerful, ruthless king shepherds, they've ingrained now for 40 years into these people. We have an enemy that is amazingly incredible
yes.
to have to deal with.
Yeah, the Amalekites, yeah, it was talking about their iniquity was not full. It had not reached a point where there was no hope. Well, finally, it reached a point there was no hope. Why? Because they were influenced by the Amalekites.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah. One of the things the United States should have learned from its bombing of Libya, from its invasion of Afghanistan, from its invasion of Iraq, and from its bombing and arming all sides in Syria, is that you can't fix Islam. There is no way to go into an Islamic country and make it better. Everything you do in an Islamic country will simply make it worse. And so that is the moral of this story, is that there's some things you just can't fix.
Yeah,
and the Amalekites
with the military,
right? And the Amalekites couldn't
do goodism, like if I treat everybody nice, they're just going to turn around and be nice people.
It's not just that you can't fix Syria with bullets and bombs. It's not just you couldn't fix Iraq by invading the place.
Mm-hmm.
You can't fix it with evidence and reason either.
No, because you have to deal with people who have evidence and reason.
Right, because the religious Islam is so stupid, it's so corrupt that not only are Muslims incapable of processing evidence reasonably, they're prejudiced against truth. Their whole world is upside down. That's what existed in Canaan, which then became Israel, is that the people were so infected, their iniquity, that which was wrong about them, was so complete that there was no way to reason with them, so there was nothing you could do about them.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, yeah. if there's nothing you can do, then you really shouldn't engage. You shouldn't accept. You shouldn't engage. You shouldn't fight. There was nothing left to do.
You shouldn't support them.
Right. Yeah, and it's also interesting that Yahweh does not...
Yeah, just off on your idea when you state that out publicly. You know, you've got to stop doing these things for these people.
Right.
You got to stop helping them. You know.
Yeah, and it's interesting too that Yahweh's willingness to fight is really limited to protecting his home for his family.
Right.
He never tells anyone to go to Babylon and fight them. To fight the Persians, to fight the Greeks, to fight the Romans. He never tells them to go fight the Egyptians. The Philistines were fought because the Philistines were foreign invaders in Israel.
Yes.
And when Israel was coming back, the Hebrews were coming back into Israel. The people tried to wipe them out along the way, and then there were people plagued with this vicious, politicized, militant religion. And so in his home, he wants evil wiped out, but only in his home.
Yeah. Well, even when we get to the point where we find out what Saul was up to and where he was being sent, even that is the border of Israel and Egypt.
Right,
you know, Elisha is right on the edge.
It's right,
depending on who's in charge at what particular time. But as far as Yahweh's concerned, that's right on the border. There is no separation. I mean, that's the separating point on there. So he never sends them down to Egypt to destroy him, and he never sends them up to a place that wasn't part of his plan for his people to begin with.
Right.
So you're certainly welcome to clean your own house.
Yes. And, you know, a lot of the stories that Yahweh tells, well, you know, the children of Israel did not follow God's advice, and therefore the whole generation was lost. And when they went into the promised land, they did not wipe out the destructive elements that were there. And so Israel became an example of what not to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so Israel becomes an example of what man does that's wrong. Right. The consequence of not listening to God.
Yeah.
And God can't use the entire world as an example. So he chose this group of people and says, here, you know, if you listen to me, this is what's going to happen. If you don't listen to me, well, then it's not going to work out for you.
Yeah. Well, what I found in going on with this, once again, I'm still trying to... put it to bed that, you know, these people actually existed. They actually controlled the Middle East. They were for about 400 years.
Mm-hmm.
After the 40 years, probably 400 plus the 40 years, they were in the desert. And it's going by evidence and more evidence and so forth. I went to all the Arabian sources.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of these names you probably know better than anybody because some of them were part of historians that you used in Prophet of Doom. At least I know one of them is. And so this is just another body of evidence and about the upheaval. And we started with Abul Faraj. And I think he was in around the 800s to 900s CE. In his
about 300 years, yeah, 200 to 300 years after the formation of Islam,
right. And the traditions reported that the Amalekites violated the privileges of the. This is him talking. The privileges of the sacred territory,
which would be Mecca.
Mecca sent them ants, insects, and forced them from Mecca. And afterwards, their lord sent drought and famine and showed them a cloudy sky at the horizon. And they marched without rest to the clouds, but they didn't reach them because the drought was at their heels. All the tribes reported experiencing along these terrible things along for about 1,000 miles along Arabia. And this would now, we're back to the time exactly when all the troubles are happening to Egypt. So we've got a good cooperation there. Mm-hmm. Then we have Masudi, which is the mid 900s. He also relates the tale of a catastrophe and swift clouds and ants and other signs of their Lord's rage. Mm-hmm. And Omiyah, son of Abu Salt, and his tribe of Takif. You don't have to know all these things, but they're. I'm just footnoting in case somebody looks them up, because Lisa's probably listening. He wrote that the violent flood carried all of them away. Now, the only thing I could figure that had may have related to is they may have seen the Egyptian army in the flood, because they were heading up that way anyway.
Right,
and that might have scared them to death.
Yeah, and they would have been on the Arabian side of the Gulf of Aqaba.
Right, they could have seen that, and that may have made them hesitate a little while before they decided to attack.
Now, keep in mind, these sources are ridiculously far removed.
They're describing events that are so similar to the ones we've already
seen. Yeah, they're 1,000 years or more removed from the actual events, but they're talking about the tradition in Arabia that the Amalekites existed in Arabia and what their nature was, and that's all consistent with what we would expect.
Yeah,
there'd be a tradition, traditions of the Amalekites there.
Yeah, and once again, Al Samudi is interesting to say that after the Amalekites invaded Syria and Egypt, they established a dynasty of their pharaohs, the Amu pharaohs.
Mm-hmm.
An Amalekite king, Elwidi, son of Duma, arrived from Syria, invaded Egypt, conquered it, seized the throne, and occupied it without opposition its life long. Masudi.
Right.
Now, we just read that from Apura.
Right, exactly.
So, I mean, it's...
cooperations. Right.
Exactly. If they're trying to spin their story to their best light, why add it if you know?
Right. So, independent history of this is what happened in Egypt, and it corroborates Yahweh's testimony.
Yeah. And, of course, I probably already mentioned this, but the speculation was that Apopo the first, which had been the first king shepherd, split his army and went to Syria and then Canaan, and then he sent a large army down to Egypt, which I think is pretty evident by so many different sources there.
Mm-hmm.
And then Manetho, as cited by Josephus once again, the Hyksos savagely burned the cities, razed the temples of the gods to the ground, treated the whole native population with utmost cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a correlation to...
Sounds like the Islamic State, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, the point is that we're getting another source reporting to the same thing that Queen Hatshepsut said exactly on the thing on her, and that's going to be found. That's on a wall.
Yes, and the great funerary temple, which is carved into the side of the cliff of Queen Hatshepsut.
Yeah. So Masudi agrees with Queen Hatshepsut's inscription, and he said there had been Amu in the midst of the delta in Hava, which is El-Arish, and foreign hordes of their number had destroyed the ancient works, and they reigned ignorant of God of the god Ra. So that's almost verbatim what she said.
Right.
And then Tabari,
Tabari is the first Islamic historian. He compiled the history of Al-Tabari. It's really the basis of being able to put a chronological organization to the founding of Islam and Muhammad, because Tabari, which was Ishaq, which was the only one to compile oral traditions on Muhammad before Tabari, his works have been lost, and so they're only known through the works of Tabari. So Tabari is the historian that has brought us the history of Islam's formation.
Well, there's absolutely no way that any of these people independently, even at this later date, could have read the hieroglyphics in the 9th century or the 800s, where they could have read that and gotten that off of her wall.
Correct. You couldn't have.
I mean, no. And
Tabari's, the first two books of Tabari are nothing but the oral traditions that have been passed down in Arabia, which would have been Amalekite traditions.
Yeah. Well, Tabari says, Guard adds a little extra here as well in his Chronicles, where he says that the king of Egypt died and another king of his relative ascends to the throne, and he was also an Amalekite race, and he was named Kabus, son of Masab, son of Nemor, son of Balsa, son of Ammon, who is a son of Amalek. So he's doing his chronology back to Amalek, which is the grandson of Esau, I think, is or a great-grandson. So it's, to me, it was fascinating that it is, once again, it's what they do give us.
Which, by the way, it's interesting, the great-grandson of Esau. Esau is the one person that Yahweh calls out by name.
Yeah.
And the Torah prophet and Solomon says, I hate him.
Oh, no, that's Ishmael. No, that's Esau.
He's of Esau. I hate him. Yeah, that's why it's interesting that in the Quran, the person that the Quran now changes to Jesus, is actually Esau. It's written as Esau.
Yeah.
And so the Jesus, and you know, the Muslims say, well, Jesus was a Muslim prophet because he's in the Quran. No, it's Esau that's in the Quran, and Esau is the person that God says he hated. And of course, Esau went off, and he married one of the daughters of Ishmael. Therefore would have been in Arabia as this was occurring.
Yeah. According to Manetho, by way of Josephus once again, he describes the Hyksos invading the country, destroying, burning, raping, ravaging. Once again, it's the same story from every source you go. They established a dynasty. They established a dynasty of Hyksos. Now here's a man who's got all the records in Egypt. But he doesn't seem to put it in his chronology, but he talks about it, which is, I find, rather odd that he couldn't put that together.
Yeah, can I just put a little spin on this, too? Is that that the Egyptians, when they conquered, they weren't rapists. The Egyptians, when they conquered, they weren't trying to be destructive. They tried to conquer the army and then extract a tribute from the people. So the last thing you want to do is destroy their buildings, their infrastructure, their country, their economy.
Yeah,
because you are trying to
get from them.
Right. But the Amalekites, like the Muslims, aren't capable of managing anything. And they're not workers. And so their idea was just to rape and plunder. So they would steal what was, I'd say, the golden era of Islam. The reason it lasted 100 years is that is as long as they could rape and plunder. And once they ran out of people to rape and plunder, there was nothing else because they couldn't productively deal with what they had bludgeoned, and there was nothing, no economy left in any of these places.
Yeah.
So the Amalekites were different than the Persians. They were different than the Babylonians. They were different than the Assyrians. Not to say the others weren't cruel. It's just that
slavery is never good, especially if you're a slave. But they fed them, or the Israelites weren't even a thought for a second to go back.
Correct.
You know, they didn't eat, and they just worked extremely hard. And if you toed the line, and it's kind of like being in a communist country. If you toe the line, you get to eat, you get to work, and some kind of life.
Yeah, you get to live the next day. If you don't toe the line, they're going to torture you and then kill you.
So, but he left on. He carried on saying that these people had left a garrison in place most suited for defense, and in particular, he secured his eastern flank to protect himself from the north, which would have been the Assyrians, would have been the only power at the time that could have given him a hard time at that at that point. Now, the interesting part about that is it has to be somewhere within easy reach of Syria, and with easy reach back to Memphis.
Right.
So El Arish now is becoming a easy to see target of where you should put your, because it is the access to both. And I actually went on a map and measured to see how far the walk would be to send an army up there, and they can do it in pretty good time. It's actually halfway between that and the capital.
Yeah,
and you could get from there to Thebes. You could get from there over to Memphis, due west. You could go up to Jerusalem, and a little bit further, you could get all the way up to Syria. So that would be an ideal place. So right now, my suspicions are, even though I've read the end of this, my suspicions are very much that he has picked El Arish as his place, and that was just mythology.
So much to learn from all of this.
Yeah.